Namo Shakyamuni Buddhaya, dear respected, beloved teacher, dear community, beloved community, good morning. I hope you've been able to sleep, to rest, and that you received some nourishment from the practices this morning. Thank you so much for the messages in the mailbox of the vow. They've been very real and very inspiring. And I felt drawn to begin today with one short poem from a modern poet, and then something that Tai wrote. So this is from Mark Nepo, and just responding to, the 10,000 joys and sorrows of our human condition. I still have a little bit of a lozenge. I think I'm going to remove it. Everything is beautiful, and I am so sad. This is how the heart makes a duet of wonder and grief. The light spraying through the lace of the fern is as delicate as the fibers of memory forming their web around the knot in my throat. The breeze makes the birds move from branch to branch, as this ache makes me look for those I've lost in the next room, in the next song, in the next stranger. In the very center, under it all, is where what we have that no one can take away, and all that we've lost, face each other. It is here that I'm adrift, feeling punctured by a holiness that exists inside everything. I am so sad, and everything is beautiful. How we live this is something that Tai wrote about very beautifully in what he calls the 14 verses on meditation. So I'll just read a few of them. Just as a bird has two wings, the practice of meditation has stopping and deep looking. The two wings depend on each other. Stopping and deep looking go in tandem. Stopping means to be still in order to recognize, to be in contact, to nourish, to heal, to calm, to soothe, and to focus the mind. Deep looking means to regard in depth the true nature of ourselves, so that understanding may arise to transform sadness and pain. The breath and the footstep generate the source of mindfulness, which enables one to recognize, to be in touch with the wonders of life, to calm, to relax the body and mind, to nourish, to heal, to protect the six senses, and to maintain right concentration. Looking deeply into reality to see the true nature of all phenomena, meditation helps us to let go of seeking, wishing, and fears, to dwell in the present moment, to transform habit energies, to give rise to understanding, liberating ourselves from afflictions. The basic meditation sutras, such as mindfulness of breathing and the foundations of mindfulness, show us step by step how we transform the body and the mind. So, dear friends, this is what we're doing here. This is what we're doing. And we can appreciate our own goodness for turning toward the direction of nourishment and healing ourselves and our society, our world, and appreciate all the generations of teachers who transmitted their experiences to help us. So yesterday I received one question about tradition and ritual from a person who'd been raised in the Catholic Church and had been wounded there and is no longer identifying as a religious member of that church. And I also received a question that says, it is the high holy days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and I'm feeling some conflict about being here, not in synagogue. Thank you for these questions. I haven't studied Judaism, so please correct me if I misstate something, but my understanding is that this time in the Jewish year, that just around the Jewish New Year, is a time for stopping and looking deeply. Is it right? Thank you. Yeah, stopping and looking deeply. I feel very moved just to feel that deep, deep connection, just such a deep connection. A time to stop and look deeply at what we've done, what we've said in the past year, what we've pursued, what we've run away from, and what has flowed from those choices that we've made, and to sense what actions our heart wants us to take next, yes? To heal and to grow in the direction we want to grow in. So in that very spirit, I encourage everyone who practices in the Jewish tradition to take anything and everything that's offered and practiced in this retreat and make good use of those things in just that way. And also I want to invite anyone who is practicing in this High Holy Days time, if there's any object that you would like to place on the lakeside altar, please, you're warmly welcome and it will be appreciated. So tradition. In each of the major spiritual traditions, there are a range of ways that people will relate to the ultimate source of what gives life to our lives, the source of our awakening, of our healing, of our growth, of our liberation from suffering. And just remembering again about what we touched on yesterday, that as it's said, right, pain is inevitable in this embodied life, and it's sometimes said suffering is optional. And just notice if that becomes a way that we then subtly judge ourselves because we are suffering. Suffering is about how we relate with the pain that does come. So if something painful arises and we're off and running into a story about how it's not supposed to be this way, there's something wrong with me, or it's probably maybe somebody else's fault if I can point it outward. And that's what we call the second arrow firing in on top of the first one, and that's the suffering that comes. Whereas if we can relate to pain by, as Thay said, recognizing it, acknowledging it, and doing what we can to take good care of it, then we don't have to go into all the suffering. And sometimes we do anyway. And so as soon as we wake up to it, that's another opportunity to make a fresh choice. And that's one of the reasons we say present moment, wonderful moment. We can make a fresh choice. It's never, never too late. We do come to a retreat and we come to practice with these old evolutionary patterns that cause us to leave, to go off into story, to scan and telescope onto what's unpleasant or what we say is wrong, bad about ourselves or those around us. So as we said, it's partly this evolutionary pattern of hypervigilance, and more immediately, it may be patterns that have been handed down to us through generations of our ancestors who just did what they felt like they had to do to survive and let us get to be here. It can also be handed to us regularly through different things in our culture. So we come to retreat and to practice with some patterns that are in place. That's why we practice. We practice to meet those patterns. We're human, and some of our patterns might be visible, like if we just find it really hard to not rush when we're eating, or really hard to refrain from starting a conversation, or really hard to leave our phone turned off. Those might be sort of visible when we're caught in those patterns. And other patterns are less visible, like continuous mental chatter. But visible or less visible, we all have them. We're human, we have them. The great news is something that scientists discovered relatively recently about our neural circuitry, that it actually remains plastic or modifiable all through our lives. So we used to believe that, I don't know, around age 7 or something, that's who a person was, and there was nothing to be done about it. That's just who we were, and so we and everyone around us proceeded on that assumption and just kept grooving that in, like, well, she's like this, and so, oh, he can't, da-da-da, or he always, and that's just how it is. It's not true. It's not true. So that's the good news of impermanence. The good news of impermanence is this, that we can change it. And just to wake up to however long it's been that we've been kind of going through the old pattern, how many times? How many times have we done it? How many times a day? How many days? How many months? How many years did we go down what we kind of figured out from what little we knew, as best we knew it, and what our parents gave us? And so, yeah, when we come to practice, we have to do it a lot of times to build and strengthen the alternate pathway, the other way that we can choose when pain comes, right? We have a bell. Just let's enjoy some fresh circuitry. The writer Viktor Frankl is, I think, sort of paraphrased as having said that between the stimulus and the response, there is a space. And in that space is our power and our freedom, because that's where we get a choice. When we can have that moment of recognition, oh, it's happening. What do I really need right now? And if you are experiencing a lot of turbulence, a lot of intensity, you've come to the right practice. Yes, I mean, we're practicing in the tradition of our teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, and the practices that have been handed to us that we're engaging in together here were forged in the inferno of decades of brutal, violent conflict, which began with ideological polarization. And I'm getting a bit of a goosebump just contemplating this, that I returned to the US from Plum Village in 2015, and I couldn't have imagined what was to come. And I just keep feeling so keenly over and over, I'm so glad that I came back when I did. As painful as it's been to go through what we've all been experiencing on many levels, it would have been more painful for me to be hearing and reading about it from overseas. And of course, I would have practiced with all my heart from there, but it feels very good or right to be here and to bring everything that I was able to absorb and receive from Thay to this very situation, because he knows it so intimately. Intimately. He has lived everything that we're living. And this is, he took all the jewels of the Buddha and all of the beautiful teachers who are our spiritual ancestors. They are your ancestors and my ancestors in the spiritual world. And the same with Jewish ancestors and Catholic ancestors. We can take the jewels, as Tai did, and find what is life-giving now, and what can heal us, what can create new circuitry in our culture and in our own bodies and everywhere in between. And we know that these conditions can be the very engine of our growth and our deepening. And I don't wish great pain on anyone, and yet we know that it deepens us and it even strengthens us. It's almost like what happens with the physical muscle. We know that the muscle has to have like tears, right? When we train the muscle, it's making little tears and then they grow back stronger. Again, I'm not a physician or a physiologist. That's my understanding of how it works. We have to have the challenge to become stronger. And that was certainly what happened for Tai and the Dalai Lama and Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and so on. These lotuses came from the deepest, darkest of mud. And if you just think for a moment about the other people that you've known who've been a source of strength for you, I know for myself, it's been the people who've been through stuff. I can feel their strength, I can feel their heartwood. And this is known about trees, right? That they require wind to create heartwood. And so you can feel that heartwood in another person. And you know how it got there, right? And even looking at your own journey through your own life, just pause for a moment now and contemplate some of the real challenges, the really hard things that you've already gone through. Just take a moment to see yourself in those situations that before you were in them, you might have thought you could never deal with that, you could never handle that, like just anything but that. And you made it, and you are stronger because of it. And so if there is intensity at our doorstep right now, we don't need to do a lot to grow ourselves and deepen. These things are growing us. They are deepening us. We don't have to go to some kind of gym and pick up more weights. Like, it's happening if we can just be here. And it's okay if we have reactivity. That's part of our humanness. That's just part of it. Can we have a bell? And so as we've been talking about, one of the kind of storylines that we need to keep recognizing and letting go of again and again and again as practitioners is that, you know, it should be different. How is it that I'm unable to stop rushing through my food? I've been practicing for a year and I'm still not able to stop rushing through my food. What's wrong with me? I'm never going to get this. Maybe we can just pause and smile and say, oh, I'm rushing through my food. Can we give ourselves a little compassion? We're not the first person to rush through their food. We're not the only one doing it at this moment in America. Right. Yeah, can we just give ourselves a little compassion, a little break, you know, a little grace. And then maybe tomorrow or the day after, we'll be able to relax just a little bit more into the meal. And we can eat just a little bit more relaxingly. It's in Thay's book, Beyond the Self. Thay recounts the brief story of the Buddha talking with a monk named Sona. And the Buddha asks Sona if it's true that he'd been a musician before he became a monk. And Sona said, yes, that's true. And the Buddha says, what happens if the string on your instrument is too loose? And Sona says, oh, well, if you pluck it, it won't make any sound. And the Buddha said, oh, and what if the string is too taut? And Sona says, it will break. So this is a story about balance and the middle way in our practice. We don't have to force ourselves to come to a screeching break from 60 miles an hour to zero. We can just do what we're able to do in this moment. And the next moment, we have a different, fresh opportunity. And another of the contributions of Western psychology has been this notion of the window of growth. So that has to do with being with intensity, and if you can just kind of picture like a window. And if we're experiencing so much intensity, we're actually above the window. We're outside the window on the high end. We're so activated and kind of freaked out. That's not going to be a place where we can make growth, because we're just like, it's like we're in four alarm fire, and that's not a place where we can grow. So what we need to do from there is these practices of grounding, soothing, stabilizing, taking refuge in what's solid, what's soft and easeful, to come back into the window, and then we can start to engage with what's there in a way that actually is creative. And the other end of the window of growth, which may be true for some of us, is that sense of being below it, where we're kind of stuck, we're feeling stagnant, we're so stable, we're just mired in, I don't know, some kind of habit, and we're not willing to go out a bit onto that edge and feel some of the ooh. So in that case, to go into the window of growth, kind of like with exercise, we need to maybe push ourselves a little bit. And so a lot of our practice, like with that story of Sona, is sensing, okay, pushing too hard, okay, let's just kind of take the foot off the gas a little bit. Or am I just kind of hanging out in my comfort zone a little too deeply and feeling a little sluggish? And so it's going to be different for each one of us, and it's not for us to judge the next person or ourselves. It's just, where are we now and what's needed now? That's mindfulness, and we can respond. So that taking refuge. I like to think of a wildlife refuge. It's such a beautiful thing to get to witness, to help create and sustain. Taking refuge. The truth is, we're always taking refuge in something. Consciously or unconsciously, we're always taking refuge in something. So if it's more unconsciously, it might be just sort of the way our parents did things or the way things were kind of grooved into us at school, or the way all of our neighbors are doing things. Many of us are taking refuge in the nearest thing, which is our phone, right? Scrolling in the phone is when we feel a little bit edgy, pick up the phone. So that's where we're taking refuge. Sometimes we take refuge in substances to get away from that feeling of rawness, of suffering. There are many other ways that we can unconsciously seek refuge. And this is not to, again, to judge ourselves harshly for doing that, because we're just doing the best we can to make it through. And yet, we do see that these are what Tara Brach would call false refuges, which just means they make us feel better for a short time, and then in fact we feel worse afterward, and we're actually suffering more. So mindfulness is what helps us wake up and say, okay, where's a true refuge for me? What really helps me cultivate health and strength and freedom and love? What's the true refuge? And so, in speaking of the traditions now, so in the Buddhist tradition, people talk about taking refuge. And if they're talking about it in a religious way, so here's where I was saying indifferent. In each religious tradition, people have different ways of relating with the ultimate and with ritual and with tradition. So in some Buddhist kind of traditions, people take it very much in the way of a religion. They see the Buddha as something like a god. And when they talk about taking refuge, they're probably talking about this kind of officially becoming religiously a Buddhist. Thai Thich Nhat Hanh was very emphatic in this tradition to say that he was not transmitting or inducting anyone into any religion. He said, I'm not teaching religion, and the Buddha was not a god. He said that very emphatically, and he even wrote a whole long book called Old Path, White Clouds to portray the Buddha as a human being. He said he's a human being. Buddha was a human being, Siddhartha Gautama, who put the time and energy into looking deeply and realized great insight and spent the next 40 plus years teaching and sharing about it. So Thay wrote that big book to portray and for people to relate with the Buddha as a human being like us. And then, if I understood correctly, sadly, this manuscript that Thay worked on for a long, long time. We have a bell of mindfulness from the technology. Hello, my technology. One, two. That Thay had written with such care and devotion, it was actually burned in a fire. Completely burned in a fire, and Thay sat down and wrote that whole book all over again. This big, the book is this big, because he was so passionate about helping all of us connect with the humanity of the Buddha, the humanity of this living person. So I'll be talking about that in a moment, taking refuge, because this afternoon we have a chance to learn together a chant about these three refuges of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So in our tradition, in the tradition of Plum Village and Thich Nhat Hanh, we do have rituals, but Thay always said Don't do anything mechanically. Don't do anything just because it's the thing you're supposed to do. Know why you're doing it. What's the meaning of what you're doing? Don't just like recite things with your mouth. Like, he wanted us to connect it with our heart and with our authenticity. It, like, what did it really mean in our own life when we say or when we do something? Yeah, so taking refuge in the Buddha, I think what I'll do is start to just describe the text of the chant, and I'm going to rearrange it a bit for now from how we'll actually be chanting it. So Buddha, the word just means awakening. It just means awake. And Thay taught us the Buddha, so in the first part of the chant, I take refuge in the Buddha, the one who shows me the way in this life. So it's really our, first and foremost, our own capacity to wake up that shows us the way, isn't it? And maybe the awakening that others have been able to live and to impart to us what they've seen. So I take refuge in the Buddha, the one who shows me the way in this life. It's the light of awareness. It's awakening. It's seeing clearly. We all have that capacity. Every one of us has Buddha nature, has the capacity to wake up. And we also can take refuge in teachers who are embodying awakening. Dwelling in the refuge of Buddha, of awakening, I clearly see the path of light and beauty in the world. That's pretty clear, yeah. And the third one is, taking refuge in the Buddha in myself, I aspire to help all people recognize their awakened nature, realizing the mind of love. So when I'm having pain, I can look toward something that feels like it sheds light, something that helps me wake up, something that gives me that space between stimulus and response. It says, oh, I don't want to go down that false refuge. That's awakening. I'm taking refuge in the Buddha when I say, yeah, I don't want to pick up my phone. The second refuge is the Dharma. In the chant we say, I take refuge in the Dharma, the way of understanding and of love. So it's the way. And again, the Dharma may be the deep teachings of Judaism, the deep teachings of Christianity, of Islam, and other traditions. I take refuge in the Dharma, the way of understanding and of love. And isn't it true that when we can understand, we suffer so much less, so much less, right? And love, we can bring love. If something's very painful, call on love, whatever that looks like for you, if it's angels, if it's the Buddha, if it's Avalokiteshvara, if it's the desert fathers and mothers, whoever it is, if it's these trees, your own breathing, call on love. Dwelling in the refuge of Dharma, I learn to open many doors on the path of transformation. When I dwell in the refuge of the way of understanding and love, new doors open for me. Taking refuge in the Dharma in myself, I aspire to help all people fully master the ways of practice and walk together on the path of liberation. The The third refuge is the Sangha, the community. I take refuge in the Sangha. I'm taking refuge in the Sangha right now, this moment. Thank you, my Sangha. I take refuge in the Sangha, the community that lives in harmony and awareness. Friends on the path, and again, this may be a congregation of a different spiritual tradition. Friends who help me remember, my capacity to wake up, who help me remember not to pick the false refuge, who are the refuge that I really need. The community that lives in harmony and awareness, dwelling in the refuge of Sangha, shining light that supports me, keeping my practice free of obstruction. So there's some feedback that goes on. Sometimes it's explicit. Sometimes it's just more implicit. And shining light, like the word reality, okay? Shining light isn't only, this is, some of us know that in Plum Village, shining light is the name of a practice where each of us asks the other members of the community to shine light on our practice and let us know where we are strong and where we can grow more. So it's not only the scraping, right? It's also the affirming of how we're strong and supportive to ourselves and others. Shining light that supports me, keeping my practice free of obstruction, helps me not get caught in the notions of what my practice is supposed to look like, but really, present. Taking refuge in the Sangha, in myself, I aspire to help all people build multifold communities and walk together on the path of transformation. So this is taking refuge as understood in our tradition, as taught by Thay Thich Nhat Hanh. And we'll get to practice chanting, and I think we'll get to chant it together in the ceremony tomorrow. This chant is chanted very regularly in Plum Village, maybe the most regularly of any of the chants, even more than the Heart Sutra. So maybe we can enjoy a sound of the bell and feel refuge right here. The other thing I wanted to share a little bit about is the practice of touching the earth. So you got to practice. Touching the earth is a phrase that Thay loves so much that there are about 6 different practices in Plum Village that are called touching the earth. So in rough chronological order, I believe the first one had to do with what classically in Buddhist traditions are called prostrations. So this is an example of something that Thay wanted us not to do mechanically and not as an act of submission to a god. He said, we're touching the earth and we're making deep contact with the earth. We can release all of our notions and be here with the earth and feel ourselves deeply part of the earth. So in the ceremony, because some of you, I'm just wondering, I didn't get questions, but I thought you might wonder a little bit about this ceremony to transmit and receive the 5 mindfulness trainings. Of course, we can practice the trainings deeply without going through any ceremony. it's a way to give us kind of a boost of energy. And as Greg said in the presentation, these beautiful words of aspiration and kind of orienting ourselves of, we could say, refuge in awakening, they're not a thing that we expect to land on and be perfectly executing, probably ever. They're the North Star that we orient toward. It's the direction we go in. So to take the ceremony is to say, this is the direction I want to go in. And there are going to be times when it feels like I'm very far, and times when it feels like it's something real. And that's what it is to practice the training. That's what it looks like. So if we like to go through the ceremony for one or more of the trainings to formally receive them and get that boost of energy, we have the option, as Gina says, the invitation, but not the obligation, to touch the earth a number of times. And we'll be doing that toward Buddha awakening and Dharma and Sangha, and also a few of what are known as the Bodhisattvas. And I honestly don't know if those were real people who lived or not, but Thay makes sure that when we touch the earth and we name some of these great beings of inspiration, that we are connecting with the quality that they represent. So you'll hear when we say, we bow in gratitude to Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of great understanding, cutting through ignorance, awakening our hearts and minds. So we're always touching the earth to connect with an energy that we have and that we can cultivate and embody. So that's the so-called prostrations, called touching the earth, or bowing deeply is another way that those are called. And I think the second one was the one that you all practiced this morning. So there's these three kind of sets of texts to contemplate deeply on our place in the stream of life through time and across space, and realize that we are not this notion of a separate self, that we are part of the whole journey of humanity and all of life. Then there was, a book in which Thay published longer contemplations that we would listen to, I think usually standing, and then touch the earth at the end. And then Thay wrote 10 earth touchings to Mother Earth, which are very beautiful in that same kind of spirit. Text contemplating our deep, deep connection to earth and all of creation. Am I forgetting one, Zan? Isn't there another one? Let's see. Maybe five. Oh, the five touchings, right. The three and then the five is another, similar to what we did this morning. Thank you, Gina. Mm-hmm. The five touchings of the earth have to do with really connecting with different qualities that we've received, both of uplifting and healing and joyful qualities, and also the qualities of suffering that have been transmitted to us through our generations spiritually and in our blood families, and calling on the strengths in our traditions to move them forward with our own body and our own heart. And that's what every one of us, I believe, is doing. If we look at generational suffering in families or in religious communities, I really believe every generation, by and large, gets it a little bit better. We get it a little bit better, and science advances at the same time to help us. We get what we inherit, and we move it forward, and what we can't transform, the next generation, it's for them to move forward. This is, evolution. And if you don't feel comfortable, getting down on the ground during those earth touchings tomorrow, it's fine to just feel the earth, feel the quality of the Bodhisattva that's been named, and know that that quality is in you, and you can make contact with that and nurture it. Maybe we could hear one sound of the bell, and then I'd like to offer one other poem from Mark Nepo. This, when I was talking with Gina about the retreat organization, and she shared with me what she was just going to go review in the introductory remarks, and she said, a retreat is more than the Dharma talks. And I said, no. I said, it's much more than the Dharma talks. You have to say, it's much more than the Dharma talks. Isn't it true? And so this poem, I think, really speaks to that. And I'll just mention as well, speaking of tradition, at one point at the end, he uses the word God, and I think it's, you'll agree with me that the word ultimate dimension is fully interchangeable here. Having loved enough and lost enough, I'm no longer searching, just opening. No longer trying to make sense of pain, but trying to be a soft and sturdy home, a soft and sturdy home in which real things can land. Real things can land. These are the irritations that rub into a pearl. So we can talk a while, but then we must listen. The way the rocks listen to the sea. And we can churn at all that goes wrong. But then we must lay all distractions down and water every living seed. And yes, on nights like tonight, I too feel alone. I too feel alone. But seldom do I face it squarely enough to see that it is a door. That it is a door into the endless breath that has no breather. Into the surf that human shells call God.